Football Weekly is on the air.
Hi, I'm Hub Arkish, and along with Eric Edholm, it is our great pleasure to bring you this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly, where every week we bring you all the news, scoops, and rumors from around the NFL before they actually happen.
We discuss the latest ruling in the labor mess, and we start our three-part series looking at how all 32 teams are affected by the lockout.
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
Hello, everybody, and thank you so much for joining us again this week for Pro Football Weekly. I am Hub Arkish, the publisher and editor, along with my co-host, senior editor Eric Edholm. We'll have a number of members of the Pro Football Weekly editorial staff joining us over the next hour as we bring you up to date on the latest around the National Football League, both labor impasse and lockout-related information, as well as lockout reports that we're going to be doing on all 32 teams over the next 2 or 3 weeks, telling you where these clubs sit beyond in limbo, obviously, and what they're going to have to focus on and try and take care of the minute that these lockouts end. But first, it's been a busy week on the lockout front, on the labor impasse front. A bit of a surprise all of a sudden this past Monday, the three-court appellate judge panel in St. Louis decided to make the temporary stay of the injunction issued by Judge Susan Rogers Nelson up in Minneapolis, permanent stay until the appeal of that injunction is heard on June 3rd. It was by a vote of 2-1. Judge Kermit Fry ruled a strong dissenting vote, thought that the injunction should be in place, that the lockout should be lifted, and yet Stephen Colleton and Dwayne Benton, the other two judges on the panel, ruled in favor of the owners. They said that irreparable damage could be done, or irreparable harm is actually the phrase, could be done to the owners in football if they didn't allow the lockout to stay in place. And Eric, quite frankly, in reading their ruling, I'm not sure what they're relying on.
Well, I read the whole thing too, and I think that for me the most interesting part, obviously you mentioned the harm part, basically what they were saying was both sides are going to suffer harm, one ruling or another. So in essence, there was no way to determine which one would be hurt more, which one would be hurt less, which one would be, you know, come out better shape, what have you. The other interesting thing was that Judge Nelson seemed to be dragged over the coals, and basically her reading of the, her interpretation of it, was not one shared by the two judges who voted on this stay.
Right, and what's really troubling about that is that basically the vote is now 2-2 because you've got Judge Susan Nelson up in the 8th District in Minneapolis, and you've got Judge Kermit Fry, who issued a very strong and scathing dissent, and then you've got the other two judges, Stephen Colleton and Dwayne Benton, who ruled in favor of the owners. Folks, we do not pretend to be lawyers or judges. I'm not saying one side is right or wrong, but what we certainly can do is apply common sense to all this and try and understand it. And I know that the judges who favor the players are saying quite simply, what you're saying will cause the owners harm is obligating them to follow the antitrust laws. That's where the harm to the owners comes. Well, the owners went to the U.S. Supreme Court in May of 2010. The court voted 9-0 that they could not be protected from those antitrust laws. And so, Eric, that's where you got to stop and scratch your head and say, well, why do these two appellate judges think that they should protect them from them?
Well, what they, in their ruling, said basically was the, you know, David Boies, who was representing the NFL, had used the argument of the Norris-LaGuardia Act, which was originally meant to protect employees, and said that, you know, they weren't subject to this injunction, saying that it could be applied to the other side. So in essence, I think that kind of trumped all that other stuff that you're talking about, the Supreme Court, who almost never ruled 9-0 in favor of anything, saying that this was the thing that trumped the other thing.
Well, you're absolutely right. And that may in fact come into play when they get to hearing the appeal on June 3rd. But that's not what this ruling was about.
This ruling was
about whether the lockout was causing irreparable harm. That's another thing that was so troubling about it, is these two judges seem to have told us how they're going to rule in the next hearing before the hearing has been held or the evidence has been presented. And so that's, again, got a lot of people scratching their heads. But here's the other thing. Everybody knows by now, or at least everybody who cares enough to pay attention, that is this Norris-LaGuardia Act of 1932 that the owners, practically their whole case is dependent on. And that is a law that was written and passed by Congress and the Senate to protect labor and to protect unions from being having injunctions issued against them asked for by ownership to protect them in nonviolent labor disputes. Well, the owner's claim is that this is a nonviolent labor dispute. The player's claim is there is no labor dispute here. Our union doesn't exist anymore, and we're ready to come to work tomorrow. And so you have to scratch your head and say, okay, I know what the law says, but what the players are saying is true. The union doesn't exist. They want to work. They're not disputing anything. What was really curious, though, is the other case that the two judges cited was the New Negro Alliance versus the Sanitary Grocery Company. It's a 1938 Supreme Court ruling, and while that ruled in favor of management, that case did not involve a lockout. It didn't even involve a labor dispute. It was about a group demanding more jobs from a group of grocery stores. And so, again, a lot of lawyers and judges scratching their heads and saying, well, where does that law even apply to this current conversation?
Yeah, and I think the point you made exactly at the start of your last answer is very important to keep in perspective, is that it's hard to imagine, based on the way that that brief was written, or not the brief, but the decision, is that this whole judge panel is not going to rule any differently, it doesn't seem, when June 3rd comes along. I think that's the thing we have to keep in mind. And so, you know, the players have to have an alternative strategy, even with the fact that Judge Doty's going to rule on this TV money soon. They could get some of the leverage back. They've got to have a plan that takes that into consideration.
You know, Eric, we've reached the point, and I don't want to do social commentary here, but the bottom line is that the two judges who have ruled in favor of the players. Judge Susan Nelson was appointed to the bench by Barack Obama, and Judge Kermit Fry was appointed to the bench by Bill Clinton. The two judges that have ruled in favor of the owners, Stephen Colleton and Dwayne Benton, were both appointed to the bench by George Bush. Now, again, we are not lawyers or judges. I don't know what the law says, but there certainly is a perception here that this has become more of a political or an ideological debate than it has a legal debate. And I think that is something that should be disturbing to everybody, regardless of which side you favor. And I don't know if I favor a side, because, again, I'm not sure what the law says. But I find it very disturbing that it appears to me that this is being decided not according to the courts, but according to the ideological beliefs of these judges.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should pay attention more to appointed judges the next time around, because it affects every element of our life, especially in the NFL.
Well, it really just gets curiouser and curiouser. Now, there is a hearing coming on June 3rd on the actual appeal that the owners have filed. And there's going to be a ruling at some point in the next couple weeks from Judge David Doty, who also heard arguments at the end of last week. He has already ruled that the owners violated their contract with the players by negotiating lockout clauses into TV agreements that were negotiated in 2008. The players have asked for $707 million in damages, and they've asked that $4 billion in lockout payments be held in escrow until the lockout is over. Judge Doty is going to rule at some point, and that is going to be a huge momentum shifter once again, whichever way he rules. Certainly there'll be an appeal on that ruling. There will be an appeal on the ruling that comes down from the June 3rd hearings, no matter what. We are getting closer and closer to the point of no return, where training camps can't open on time and the season can't open on time if these guys don't start focusing on having an agreement as opposed to who's going to win in court. That's going to do it for this segment on the labor impasse. God, we're getting tired of this, folks. Let's hope it gets lifted soon. We're going to talk some football in just a minute. Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly. I'm Hub Arkish. Eric Edholm is alongside. And Eric, we're going to talk a little bit of way we hear it before we begin our series of lockout reports on all 32 NFL teams. We'll only get to about a dozen of them today, and then we'll pick it up again next week. But first, in Dallas, it just gets more and more interesting. The Cowboys have had organized workouts amongst the players. Obviously, no contact allowed from the coaches, the owners of the front office. And yet, apparently, Dez Bryant, who missed one of the earlier workouts, one or two of the earlier workouts, and allegedly had talked to Tony Romo and Jason Witten about it, and there was a valid reason that he couldn't participate, so he wanted to be with his teammates, has now shown up for some workouts. And owner Jerry Jones, who you could actually ask the question, should he be even commenting on it? I don't know what Roger Goodell will say about that, has shown some satisfaction to know that Bryant is out there with his buddies, and he's acknowledged that they're very worried, forget the off-the-field stuff, they're very worried about that ankle that he fractured and dislocated at the end of last season.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, when I thought about what the impact of the Cowboys might be this offseason, I thought about Tony Romo's collarbone, and I thought about Dez Bryant, not only from a health standpoint, from a maturity standpoint. He's already been in the news several times, and they clearly want to get him under wraps and get him with the team, and this is probably the best thing they can do right now is get him near Tony Romo, who's, look, has expanded his role as a leader, and Jason Witten, who's been entrenched as a leader for several years now, and, you know, other guys like that. And so it's important for him to be around the system, even if the coaches aren't able to watch.
Yeah, I'm curious. There's a quote here from Jason Garrett, the head coach. It'll be his first year as the full-time head coach. Of course, he was the interim head coach for the last 9 weeks last season. He says that the team talks to a third party regarding how players are recovering from injury. And Garrett said all players coming off injuries last season, John Phillips, Kevin Ogletree, of course, Tony Romo, Akwasi Owusu-Ansah, Sean Lissamore, and Dez Bryant are doing pretty well. Again, it would seem, now the Cowboys have already been fined once as one of those five teams that was having illegal contact. Is this okay as far as you know? Have you done any research on this? Should they be talking to a third party about this?
Why do I suspect Deion Sanders is that third party? He always seems to have his hands in lots of pies, and Dez Bryant, he's already given up on. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know who the third party is. I've never been able to find out what, you know, what their system is, what their method is. But it seems like they're sort of, you know, it's like college basketball recruiters. They find a way to get around the rules, even if it's not written down that way.
Well, and you had a great piece about 10 days ago, which got picked up quite a bit nationally, about a number of agents that you had spoken to who had been contacted, quote, illegally, it's my air quotes that you can't see on the radio there, right after the draft. You know, and we know what's going on. We know all these teams are breaking these rules. They're breaking them carefully, you know, as to which ones are, you know, no harm, no foul. But this is Jason Garrett pretty much tipping his hand. And folks, I would almost predict for you another fine coming for the Dallas Cowboys for illegal contact with these players. Let's move on to the Washington Redskins, because I've never seen a more fascinating quarterback situation. Clearly, Donovan McNabb is still the best quarterback on the team. The only one under contract, by the way. And yet everybody has pretty much written him off. Figure he'll be gone as soon as this mess is over. Rex Grossman is not under contract, but you would assume the longer the lockout goes, the best shot he has of being their opening day starter because he's most familiar with the system. You got John Beck, who was a complete bust in Miami, but who Mike Shanahan seems to like, and he got a little bit of playing time at the end of last year. Some people think he's the heir apparent, and everybody knows that they're going to try and deal McNabb and bring in another veteran once this lockout mess is over.
Yeah, I mean, it's been fascinating to see Beck and Grossman, and it's been more Beck than Grossman, but both those guys seem to go out and say that, you know what, I'm the guy, I believe I'm the starter. Now, granted, of course they're going to say this. You know, Grossman's trying to get a contract, and Beck really hasn't had an opportunity to play in the NFL since 2007, so he sees this as his rebirth or whatever. But it makes you wonder if that's actually the plan that's going to happen. You know, I mean, if that really is the backup plan, the contingency, the, hey, if we don't get the right veteran we like, you know, depending on who's available in the market, we know they're not going to be able to get Kevin Cobb. They've already sort of hinted that Vince Young is not really their guy. Who else is there? There aren't a lot of guys. So, hey, this is at least what they're going with for now. And Beck seems pretty confident that he's the guy.
Interesting stories out of Detroit as well, and these are not coming from Jim Schwartz or Marty Mayhew. These are just people who have had access to or at least talked to some of the players at their informal workouts. Injured players. Apparently Matthew Stafford's shoulder has been prepared pretty well because rookie Titus Young is already commenting on the fastballs he's been throwing him from 40, 50 yards away. Gosder Chirilis, microfracture surgery in December. Now, that normally is an 8 to 16 month recuperative procedure. He's been at the informal workouts, and Javid Best, who's been bothered by turf toe and all kinds of problems. They say all three of these guys apparently look pretty good at these informal workouts.
Yeah, let's start with Stafford. I mean, you know, the receivers have been calling him finger breakers just because he's been throwing the ball so well. But more important to Lions fans, they should realize that he's really worked on his overall endurance and his overall conditioning this offseason, because, you know, the question about him isn't whether he's tough enough, it's whether he's a China doll. He's only been, you know, played 13 of his 32 games in the NFL, done a lot of upper body work, a lot of chest work. They said he's added arm strength, which he already had a strong arm. So if you have Chirilis healthy, you've got Best healthy, you've got Matthew Stafford there, Lions offense, forget that defensive line, which could be great. The offense really showing signs that it could be special in time.
All right, Eric, thank you very much. We're going to take another quick commercial break here, and we will begin our lockout reports on all 32 teams. We've got the NFC South coming up first. Pro Football Weekly, Football Weekly rolls on, and we are kind of excited, actually, to introduce a new piece this week that's going to run over the next couple weeks. We're going to give you an in-depth lockout report on all 32 NFL teams. What are the two or three biggest questions facing each club as they try and weather the storm and hopefully get ready to go into free agency, open training camps, and play football again soon? We're going to start with Associate Editor Dan Parr, and Dan has the NFC South and the Chicago Bears. We'll save the Bears along with the other NFC North teams, but we'll do the South right now. And Dan, the team that I've got to start with is the Carolina Panthers, because obviously they have the most questions of anybody in the league. They were the worst team in the league, and they've got Cam Newton, and yet I guess the biggest question you start with is, who's going to be the quarterback on opening day?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with how things go with the rest of the offseason. If there is time to prepare Cam Newton for week one, if the lockout is over and everything is settled, if he has time to sit down with Rob Chudzinski, offensive coordinator, Mike Shula, the quarterback's coach, and they feel comfortable enough to put him out there with a simplified system than they would have expected in a full offseason, then maybe he is a guy. But I think there's a better chance at this point that Marty Herney goes out and signs or trades for a veteran quarterback to come in and kind of ease Newton into things. A guy who's obviously going to have to be comfortable being a placeholder, because he will not be the long-term answer, and sooner rather than later, Newton's going to be the starting guy.
And, you know, Dan, obviously they have other concerns as well, and one of them surrounds their best playmaker in Steve Smith. And if you ideally want to have Newton come in as a rookie, you'd like to give him a receiver of Steve's quality, but all signs seem to point towards him exiting. How do you think this will end up playing out?
Eric, as you've reported, you know, Smith is clearly, while he's saying all the right things and being very respectful to the Panthers organization, he wants a chance to compete for a contending team, and it doesn't look like the Panthers are that right now. So Smith will most likely, although again, a lot unknown at this point, but you'd think he'll be playing for a different team by the time next season starts. And then you're going to have Cam Newton or a veteran quarterback, you know, whether they bring Kerry Collins back for a year or are able to find another placeholder to come in. He's going to have a very, very young receiving core. Now, in free agency, you would think that that would be a target for the Panthers. If Smith does depart, they will go out and sign a guy to come in. But you're looking at David Geddes, Brandon LaFell, two guys who showed some promise last year, but very much still developing players. You know, Armonte Edwards is coming off a very, very disastrous rookie season. A lot of question marks about whether he'll develop into a capable slot receiver. They spent a pick on a receiver this year in Pilaris, but I don't know. I don't think that Smith is futures in Carolina, and that's going to be another obstacle for Cam Newton.
All right, Dan, I'm going to boil the Atlanta Falcons down to one question. We know they need another end across from John Abraham, and you know, we know they've got some issues to deal with on the offensive line and free agency. But what this comes down to is the Atlanta Falcons appear to have mortgaged the future to get one player to turn them from the NFC's number one seed into a Super Bowl team. How does the pressure work on Mike Smith and the rest of that club, and did they do enough?
Well, I don't think the pressure will be too much for him. It's going to end up being Arthur Blank's decision. If this doesn't pay off right away, I think he's going to be patient with this group. I mean, he's given extensions to Mike Smith and Thomas Dimitroff this offseason. He had to give him the green light to go out and make this move to trade up 21 spots in the first round and get Julio Jones, which cost the Falcons picks, including their first rounder next year, but also cost Arthur Blank a lot of money. He's on board with the game plan, the long-term approach that these two guys are taking, Dimitroff and Smith. So, yes, they did make a huge gamble this year, but I think they were able to because they really felt confident and comfortable with their statuses in terms of Arthur Blank's mind. So it was going out on a limb for Thomas Dimitroff, no question. And he said, you know, if it doesn't work out in a few years, I'm fried. Well, we'll see. I have a feeling that the Falcons are competitive and back in the postseason, people will be talking about this trade a whole lot less.
Dan, as we look at another one of your teams, the New Orleans Saints, you know, it's funny, they recently had a softball game. Drew Brees was there, and Reggie Bush was there. And yet the loudest ovation came for the new guy, Mark Ingram. How does Ingram's arrival affect Reggie Bush? We've heard him already say goodbye to the city of New Orleans, thanks for the memories, that sort of stuff on Twitter. And yet both he and Sean Payton have now said that they would like to work something out. How likely is it? How much money is he going to have to give up in order to stay with this team?
Quite a bit of money, Eric. He's due to make $11.8 million next year. Reggie had acknowledged in recent days, you know, I'm going to have to take a pay cut. There's going to have to be a renegotiation. The question is, is the bottom line for him going to be a little higher than it is for the Saints? Is he going to be expecting more than the Saints are willing to give him? He said the Saints are his first choice, but I still think his future is very uncertain in New Orleans. And Mark Ingram's addition, while in the Saints' mind, didn't really change Reggie Bush's status. He's a role player. He's going to, if he's there next year and accepts the pay cut, he'll get a few carries here and there. He'll be a punt returner. He'll catch some passes. They don't view him as an all-around complete back that they can rely on to carry a heavy workload. He's just not durable enough for that. So the drafting of Mark Ingram didn't really affect the way the Saints plan to use Reggie Bush, but it did apparently affect Reggie Bush's psyche a little bit.
All right, Dan Heavy, hang on for just a second. We'll talk more about the Saints and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers after this quick break. And we are talking about the 32 NFL teams' lockout reports on each club. We're in the NFC South with Associate Editor Dan Parr. And, Dan, we had talked about Reggie Bush just before the break. One other story in New Orleans. I don't know where it came from. It's sneaking up on everybody. But Drew Brees in the last year of his contract, going to be very expensive to re-sign with or without a CBA in place. Where are the Saints at on that?
Well, a lot's going to depend on what everything shapes up after the CBA is finalized. Whenever that does happen, we don't know when that'll be or what it'll look like. But I think it's pretty safe to say the Saints want Drew Brees back, even though he's been one of the lead plaintiffs in the NFLPA case against the NFL. And I think Drew Brees, who's become really an incredible member of the community there in New Orleans, would like to stay put as well and make that his home for many years to come. So I think eventually we'll see something work out, but it's probably not going to happen quite as soon as some Saints fans would like it to see it happen. I think that this was something that probably would have been maybe settled by now or around the time training camp starts in a typical year. May linger into the season or perhaps into this upcoming offseason.
All right, Dan, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, it's pretty obvious where to start. They need to get better on defense up front, more pass rush, the front seven. They used the third overall pick a couple years ago on Gerald McCoy. He comes back from injury. Their first two picks this year, Adrian Claiborne and Daquan Bowers, both come with injury questions as well. If these guys aren't healthy, are the Bucs taking a step backwards? And what do they do about Aqib Talib?
Well, to be honest, I don't think they'll take a step backwards if those two guys aren't ready to go, because that pass rush was pretty atrocious at times last year, so they'll be kind of stuck in neutral in that area of the game if those two guys don't come in and make an immediate impact. But they should be upgrades, even if Bowers' knee is not quite 100% by the time the season starts. And he and his agent say it will be, but I think that that's certainly an upgrade there for them if those guys can completely, you know, stay off injured reserve. And with Aqib Talib, I think the lockout really gave the Bucs the benefit of not having to make a quick decision on him. If we were in a year where transactions could have been made, at the time he was, you know, face these serious charges, he might have been cut right then and there. But now his court day is coming up here toward the end of the month. We'll see what happens there. And Mark Dominic's watching very closely. I spoke to him around the time of the draft, and there's no decision that's been made on Talib quite yet. They're waiting to see what happens. So I think there's a chance that if things work out in Talib's favor in court, that he will be back with the team.
All right, Dan, thank you very much. We want to welcome in Arthur Arkish now. Arthur is our associate editor covering the AFC South. And, Arthur, we're going to start with the Houston Texans. I think anybody who's a fan of the NFL could give you the three biggest questions. Can Wade Phillips work his magic on that defense? Can Mario Williams play outside linebacker? And will Gary Kubiak be the head coach in 2012?
Well, starting with Wade Phillips and his hoping to reach into his bag of tricks again. He's had a lot of success as a defensive coordinator, not so much obviously in recent history as a head coach, but he has a way of coming into a new team and turning a defense around in a hurry. So they obviously focused on that side of the ball in the draft. They got, you know, potentially three guys who can start right away in J.J. Watt and Brooks Reed and then Brandon Harris. So there's a lot of pieces in place. They've also got, as you mentioned, Mario Williams. You got very talented D'Amico Ryans, Brian Cushing, also very talented, Connor Barwin. These are all guys who played in a total of two games last year together because of injury. So if they come back and they're all ready to go, this could be a defense that's definitely on the up and up next season under Phillips.
Arthur, the Jaguars, another team of yours that certainly could use some defensive help. They went Blaine Gabbert in the draft, and you can certainly understand why, even in a lockout shortened offseason. And yet, doesn't the fact that we don't really have an offseason program yet at this point mean that Gabbert is more likely to sit and that David Garrett is still the starter for now?
Absolutely. Gene Smith, Jack Del Rio actually said prior to making Gabbert the guy of the future that they prefer to bring a quarterback along slowly, let him learn from the sidelines watching a veteran. David Garrard, I think we all know what his ceiling is. Not sure you're going to see a whole lot more out of him, but he is definitely a serviceable starter, and he's a guy that can build a bridge to Gabbert. So I would anticipate him being the starter at least to begin the season, and until he has one of those games that we all know Garrard is capable of, he's quite streaky. You may then see some calls for Gabbert, but I think that's going to happen at least not initially.
All right, Arthur, we're going to have you hold on for just a minute. We will get to your other two clubs, the Colts and the Titans, right on the other side of this quick commercial break. Hub Arkush and Eric Edholm in studio, bringing you this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. Just prior to the break, we were visiting with associate editor Arthur Arkush, and Arthur covers the AFC South. We have talked a little bit already about the Jacksonville Jaguars. We touched quickly on the Houston Texans, and now we move to the Indianapolis Colts. And Arthur, the Colts need to fix their offensive line. That's the bottom line. There's other things you can talk about, but even without an offensive line, they're a playoff team. If they can get the offensive line right, they're a Super Bowl contender again. Did they get that job done in the draft?
Well, they certainly took some major steps towards doing so. They spent their first two picks, as we know, Boston College left tackle Anthony Costanzo, Villanova tackle slash guard Ben Ijelana, with their first and second rounders. Both of those guys are expected to be plugged in right away. Anthony Costanzo is a guy who could man that left tackle post for the next decade, potentially. That's certainly what the Colts are hoping for. Ijelana is a guy who has the versatility to play inside or outside. We anticipate he will probably start at guard and perhaps eventually move outside to supplant Ryan Deem once his time is up. What was really beautiful about what the Colts did in the draft is they solved multiple problems at once, because you look at a guy like Charlie Johnson, he's a potential free agent, but if the Colts bring him back, he's more apt to play guard anyway. So you slide Costanzo into his spot, you move Johnson inside and potentially replace Kyle DeVan. You got Ijelana on the other side. Ryan Deem's probably got one more good year left in him, and they went a long way towards fixing that offensive line, absolutely.
And Arthur, of course, the reason why they have to improve their offensive line is not just to get a better running game, but also, of course, to protect Peyton Manning. He may be on the back half of his career. He's obviously the most important player in that Colts franchise, and it was 9 months ago that you and I were out at Anderson University and dealing with the heat and the first day of training camp there, and Jim Irsay, the owner, came out and said, look, we're going to take care of Peyton Manning. We want him to get a long-term deal. And yet Tom Brady and the Patriots, not a team that makes deals in advance a lot, came to an accord before the Colts were able to do anything with Manning. We got to the lockout, no deal. Is that going to be one of their first orders of business once all this labor business is finished up?
Well, you would certainly think so. It's kind of interesting. It hasn't happened yet. The Colts did try and negotiate with Manning during the season, during the team's bye week. Manning declined, said he did not want any distractions at that point in time. You have to kind of wonder. I mean, it's not for lack of trying. These two sides have gotten together, and they have not been able to reach a deal yet. As you mentioned, the framework has been laid by the Patriots and Tom Brady. So you would have to assume that as soon as this all gets resolved, the first order of business will indeed be getting Peyton Manning locked up and a Colt for the rest of his career.
Arthur, let me ask you quickly about the Tennessee Titans. Obviously, we wonder if their second biggest playmaker, Kenny Britt, behind Chris Johnson, of course, can stay out of jail long enough to make plays. You look at the way the defense came apart last year, but the one big question we've got to focus on here, for the first time in 17 seasons, no Jeff Fisher. Mike Munchak is a first-time head coach. He's been in the organization 30 years. Is he ready, and can he, in his rookie year, turn this team around?
Can he in his rookie year? I don't think so, but I think that he has certainly put in the time, 30 years with the organization, where he deserves the shot. The Titans elected to name Fisher's replacement by staying in-house and kind of, keeping some continuity there. So, as I mentioned, Munchak has certainly earned a shot. His first order of business may be taking care of, Kenny Britt and what to do there, but most importantly, he's gonna have to kind of he's going to have to set the environment for the type of working environment he wants for his coaches and his players, and he's going to have that chance as soon as this all gets resolved.
All right, Arthur, thank you very much. We now want to move on and welcome in executive editor Dan Arkush, and Dan covers the NFC West. And, Dan, I'm going to start with the Arizona Cardinals, and while we do have two or three questions on every team, there's only one, as near as I can tell, that matters with the Arizona Cardinals. Who is going to play the quarterback position? Because the guys they finished last year with weren't getting much done.
That's correct, Hub. I don't think any of the five quarterbacks who actually ended up starting last year are going to be back. I mean, definitely not Derek Anderson, who failed miserably in the starting role. I mean, John Skelton, maybe a year or two from now, he's got potential. He went 2-2 as a starter at the end of last year, but he's nowhere near ready. So all signs point toward the Cardinals going after a veteran via free agency or trade. We've gone over these names week by week. Kevin Kolb, Mark Bolger, Kyle Orton. We just have to wait and see.
It seems that with a team that, like you said, has a few options at this point at quarterback and a defense that grossly underachieved last year, that the running game might be something that they would feature. And one of the more interesting picks in the draft was Ryan Williams in the second round. Not that he was a second-round pick. Ryan Williams is a very talented running back out of Virginia Tech, but that he ended with the Cardinals, a team that has a number of runners already. They took Beanie Wells in the first round a few years ago. Tim Hightower was kind of the guy down the stretch. You've got Larod Stevens-Howlings, who's been a great change of pace guy. So where does Williams sort of wedge his way into the picture?
Well, Eric, I mean, you're definitely right about them having a lot of guys there, but by all accounts, they just really like Williams, and they just think that, you know, he's got potential to really be, you know, a first-class running back. His medical history, though, suggests that he's not an every-down guy, and it's just going to be interesting to see what they do, because they have Beanie Wells, Tim Hightower, Larod Stevens-Howlings. They're saying that all this competition is a good thing, but there's no way that all these guys are going to remain on the roster.
All right, Dan, hang on just a minute. We've got three more teams in the West to cover, but we do have to get a quick commercial break in. We'll be back with the St. Louis Rams in just a moment. We are back with more of our NFL lockout reports, all 32 clubs today and next week, maybe even into the week after. Right now we're in the middle of the NFC Western Division with executive editor Dan Arkish. And, you know, Dan, the St. Louis Rams were one game away from the playoffs last year, albeit a couple games under 500. The bottom line is head coach Steve Spagnuolo obviously has the defense pointed in the right direction. He adds defensive end Robert Quinn. They should be fine there. Offensively, Sam Bradford, great rookie year, but now a new offensive coordinator, and it is the wunderkind, Josh McDaniels. I would guess the one big question about this club is how do Bradford and McDaniels mesh?
It's going to be really interesting to see, you know, and with the shortened time frame, with the lockout now, you really have to think that McDaniels, who, you know, has a track record for being pretty sophisticated, they might have to scale things down. But it's definitely going to be a much more wide-open attack with varied formations, a lot of four wide sets, which McDaniels' predecessor, Pat Shurmur, hardly ever used.
Dan, if there's a team that is affected by this lockout, I think the San Francisco 49ers probably have to rate near or right at the top because you've got a new defensive coordinator. Of course, you've got a new head coach in Jim Harbaugh. And you got possibly a new quarterback situation. We know Colin Kaepernick's in the mix. We aren't sure if Alex Smith is going to be back, although it seems like he will. Just talk about all the challenges they face in this lockout offseason.
Well, you know, let's start right off with the Alex Smith saga. I think the latest now is that it really does appear, Eric, like he's going to be the guy. He pretty much said as much just earlier this week. He finally made an appearance after lying low. So it looks like Harbaugh has convinced Alex Smith that he's the man again, and that's a key thing. But like you said, you know, a new head coach, new schemes on both sides of the ball, and even with Alex Smith, you know, having some familiarity with San Francisco, it's a whole new deal. Yeah, a strong case could be made for the Niners, you know, really being affected by this lockout more than any other team.
Well, and another fascinating case of a head coach convincing a player of something during a period where they have no contact whatsoever, but we know exactly
osmosis,
what you're saying, Dan.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, obviously we know what's going on out there. They probably have not had direct contract negotiations. But it sounds like one of those deals where Harbaugh and Trent Baalke have let, you know, Smith know through the media that they want him. And so Smith is letting them know back through the media that, okay, I want to be there. Obviously, they will still have to work out a contract once this is all settled as far as the labor impasse.
Yeah, and it's going to be Alex Smith's seventh coordinator in seven seasons. It's really a lot to have to go through. Now, he's a pretty sharp guy. You know, it's just going to be interesting to see how he meshes with Harbaugh, who has a tremendous track record. Obviously, luck at Stanford and really doing, you know, a good job there.
You know, Dan, that seems to be a recurring theme in the NFC West, rotating defensive coordinators. In Seattle, Daryl Bevel, who, of course, was Brett Favre's guru in Minnesota, will now be the fourth different offensive coordinator in four seasons for the Seahawks. And then to add to that, they bring in Tom Cable, the former head coach of the Raiders, who will be the offensive line coach and assistant head coach. And like the Niners, well, actually, I guess different from the Niners now, they don't have a clue who their quarterback's going to be.
No, that's still pretty much up in the air, although, you know, it's looking better for Matt Hasselbeck. I think as time goes on, he has come to grips with the fact that he just really, really loves Seattle and, you know, would be willing to play more of a mentoring role if he had to. But, you know, as much as anything, he really is a pretty good fit for this offense that Bevel has in mind, you know, West Coast offense with short, precise passing. And so he's not a bad fit there at all in that regard.
Dan, in the final 30 seconds or so, as we look at the Seahawks team, and we've talked about Matt Hasselbeck several times, is it better, do you think, to move on from him or to keep him for another year and keep him in place and with this offensive change?
I think you got to stick with him for now, because I just don't think Whitehurst is ready, Eric. You know, Hasselbeck, when he's good, he can be pretty good. The big thing here, though, with this team is more of a run game. And I think a real key will be Marshawn Lynch, who I see having a much more productive season.
All right, Dan, thank you very much. That wraps up three divisions. We've got five more to come in the coming weeks. We've also got the publisher's pen ahead right after this quick commercial break.
And now with the publisher's pen, the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkish.
Eric, thank you very much. And you know, it's really been an interesting week. It's getting to be frustrating. It's getting to be difficult keeping focus. The only real story in the NFL right now is the labor impasse and the lockout. And quite frankly, it's not why fans are attracted to the game. It's certainly not what media enjoy covering about the game. And I'm sure neither the players or the owners are enjoying it anymore either. But what I think became disturbingly obvious this week is that there is a failure in leadership on both sides in this labor impasse, and it's becoming to be a real problem towards getting a settlement. Now, Roger Goodell is clearly not Paul Tagliabue. He is clearly not Pete Rozelle. He has done a very nice job of trumpeting and parroting the owner's position. But when he continues to try and take the high ground, talking about the good of the game and protecting everybody's interest, the players and the fans, it's become painfully obvious he represents nobody but the 32 NFL owners who are paying him a $10 million salary and the only ones who get to vote on his employment. He's not interested in the good of the game. He's trying to get the deal that the owners want. Unfortunately, on the flip side, you have a negotiator in DeMarie Smith who may be even less focused on what's good for the game, what's good for the players, what's good for the owners and the fans. We don't know what D. Smith really represents. He claims to represent the players and the players only. He has been obnoxious. He has been argumentative. He has been acrimonious from day one, and he tried to paint that as necessary in leading a labor fight and that had the players' best interests at heart. But he's given some quotes and some statements in the last couple days and weeks that make me wonder who he's really representing. Now is the time, whether you do it via the court mediation or negotiations, doesn't matter whether you're a union or decertified, there should be an effort to get a deal done, and he's clearly not making one. He's trying to win his battle in court, and that is serving nobody's best interest. For Pro Football Weekly, I'm Hub Arkish. We want to give our best thanks, as always, to Randy Meyer, outstanding producer and engineer. Of course, to Syndication Networks, our home studio. And most of all, to you, our listeners, thank you so much for listening. Join us again next week, same time, same station, for Pro Football Weekly.